Ahoy, mateys. You are about to listen to the podcast version of the Naked American Songbook from WNYC and me. Because of these things called copyright laws, we are not allowed to play the complete recordings of the songs we are talking about. But we've got a lot of conversation and good times with Molly Ringwald, and you will at least get a taste of the music that she loves. Now light 16 candles and listen up.
Good evening, friends. Can I call you that? Friend? I hope so. But then again, that word has started to slide around a lot of late. Seems just having met someone qualifies them for the designation. Now, not to get all old man fist shaky on your ass, but back in my day, a friend was someone you shared some pretty serious stuff with. Lots of it, actually, and over a long period of time. Now, I keep my friends for a lifetime, and it's a privilege, not a right, one that I earn, I hope. So, we can use that word if you want, but let's agree to what it means before we get too comfy with it. Now, some of my most enduring friendships were forged over the subject of music. Sharing songs is how many a teenage bond is made, if not band. Mixtapes, playlists, dance parties, these are just some of the ways that young folks teach each other who they are. But such exchanges get fewer and farther between as we get older, until downright rare is the instance when two adults form a friendship by trading favorite versions of a tune by Hoagy Carmichael, or Tom Waits, or even Dolly Parton. Well, my guest today and I did just that. Molly Ringwald and I became buddies working on a record together, and then friends soon after by choosing which songs we'd sing together on a gig. From there, it was a short distance to genuine friendship, and to honor her and all that we share, I'd like to preface our conversation today with a song by an artist whose various takes on friendship bear sharing time and time again, Ricky Lee Jones. Now, love songs are the basic unit, the dollar bill of the songwriter. Friend songs are like the $50 bill, harder to find and harder to spend without being suspected of forgery. In her portraits of lowlifes, drinkers, and honorable of petty thieves, Ricky Lee Jones brilliantly renders the detailed little exchanges between friends that console, comfort, and sustain, often through life's very hardest knocks. It's what real friendship is, at least in my day. Also, she grooves like nobody's business, and you can hear in this groove, if not the lyrics, which you'll have to Google, that all the folks in this joint, Danny's All-Star joint, to be exact, are looking out for each other. This is the Naked American Songbook, my friends. The first round is on me.
Machine and he said, come on, Cecil, give me a dollar. Come on, Cecil, give me five. I'm in a halfway house on one-way street. Ooh, and I'm a quarter past living down.
Ricky Lee Jones, Danny's All-Star Joint from her eponymous first album, her debut. My God, most people would be happy to call that a whole career, but that record was her first, one of many masterpieces which are on constant rotation in my little household. But now on to my guest, my dear friend, Molly Ringwald. You may know her from her recent album, except sometimes from her book, When It Happens to You, from her advice column for The Guardian, from The Facts of Life. She's one. I don't know. What else did you do?
She's doing it to get a rise out of you. Just ignore him.
There were a couple movies I did a long time ago. Yeah.
Tell me about them.
Well, they took place in high school.
Can't believe I'm actually doing this.
One of them had a meal in the title. I had
the dinner party.
No. Breakfast Club.
Breakfast Club. Oh, that's right. That's right. I think I have seen that movie. So, yeah, you've made some movies. We all know that.
Shut up!
Right. I remember when you and I first started hanging out together. Well, when we first met, you didn't like me. And thought I was annoying.
I didn't know who you were. That's all.
Nobody knows who I am.
No,
That's the story of my life.
You were producing the Kiki and Herb Christmas album that I performed on with Isaac Mizrahi.
I saw your face and heard you call my name.
Isaac, it's Molly.
Oh, are you there? Oh, my friend, we're older but no wiser. You dumb old thing. For in our hearts, the dreams are still the same. Those were the days, my friend. We thought they'd never end. We'd sing and dance forever and a day. We'd live the life we choose. We'd fight and never live. But we were young and sure to have our way. Those were the
days. And you were producing it, but nobody...
And Debbie Harry and Rufus Wainwright.
And no one told me that there was a producer, that...
This fat little Jew running around with
with
his
dog. That was our first meeting.
But I remember being a little nervous about the subject of your films ever coming up, because I thought you would well be within your rights to be like, look, I just don't want to talk about that stuff anymore. I'm exhausted.
Yeah.
But you don't, you know, you seem endlessly kind of cheery and even grateful for the experience, which I
like. Yeah, I mean, it's impossible not to be grateful for the experience. But yeah, some days I'm just incredibly bored by it. But some days it's really not boring at all. Sometimes it's really interesting, particularly when I'm with my kids or, you know, with Matilda. And
she's getting to that age, right?
Yeah, it's all new for her. And, you know, watching the film with her was an incredible experience.
Yeah, it must be odd for her. She's the one teenager in the world, other than the twins who will be teenagers one day, who are going to have a weird sort of subjective experience with regard to watching these seminal teenage coming-of-age films.
Yeah.
It would make me really uncomfortable.
I thought it was going to make me really uncomfortable when I watched it with her, but it really didn't. I was mostly just nervous that she wasn't going to like it, you know.
Really?
Yeah.
She's 12.
I know, but... Yeah, I don't know. I can't say I'm very objective about the movies at all. I've never seen the movies the way that other people see them, because I have all these experiences wrapped up in them. And also I have that experience of feeling like I'm looking at baby pictures of myself. And eventually you're like, all right, so I was cute. Okay. Can we move on?
You're still cute.
Thanks.
Still great.
Thanks.
What's interesting to me about you in this regard is that long before you hit the screen and hit it very big, as you did almost immediately, you were singing.
Yeah.
You were singing from the age of 3, so far as I can tell.
Yeah, that's right. That's when I started.
And you were singing great American songs. You weren't, like, singing rock and roll tunes.
Yeah, well, because my dad's a traditional jazz musician. That's really the music that we listened to around the house.
And you didn't decide, that's my dad's music. I'm going to go check out Kiss or something.
Eventually I did. In, you know, my teen years, that was my form of rebellion, I guess, a musical rebellion. I got really into David Bowie and David Bowie, and The Cure, and Elvis Costello, and, you know, all those bands. But I never abandoned the Great American Songbook entirely.
Not only did you not abandon it, you went on to record it.
That's right.
We have bootleg recordings of you and real recordings of you, studio recordings, live recordings, appearances on television. So, you know, you've not only not abandoned it, it sort of sustained you. Am I right?
Yeah, you are right. I like to call this kind of music, it's my musical comfort food. Whenever I'm not feeling great or if I want to just feel grounded, I listen to jazz music.
Really?
Yeah.
And that includes some of the tunes you brought for us to listen to today, am I right?
That's right.
Do you listen to Bessie Smith?
I do. But when I was a child, I listened to her a lot. When I started singing, I was singing with my dad's band. I was 3 years old.
Has he no shame?
and he introduced me to Bessie Smith, and there was just something about her that I just really responded to it. And so a lot of the songs that I sang with my dad's band were songs that I learned from Bessie Smith. Of course, I couldn't sing all of them because, you know, some of them were just
absolutely
filthy.
You're a 3-year-old white girl.
Filthy. Yeah. Some of them are just, you know, has nothing to do with race. They're just mostly it has to do with sex, you know. I need a little sugar in my bowl. I really wanted to sing that song. And my parents were like, no, no, we're not going to do that one.
I need a little sugar in my bowl. I need a little hot dog between my rolls. You getting different, I've been told. Move your finger, drop something in my bowl.
But you couldn't have known what it meant. You must have thought
not.
It meant actual sugar.
I did.
And in your actual bowl.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was amazed because, well, we're going to play it in a second. First, we're going to listen to this recording of Bessie Smith singing A Good Man Is Hard to Find, which you sent to us, and I'm really excited. I have to say my own experience with Bessie Smith is like sort of like the national parks. Like, I'm really glad it's there, but I just never go.
Mm-hmm.
I'm happy that it's there. And like, Bessie Smith is obviously one of the most important giants of the 20th century.
Yeah.
But I just don't find myself listening to her.
Yeah. No, I get that.
So I'm interested in someone who does. Like, the sonic experience for me just kind of leaves me cold.
Yeah. Well, it was really sort of my introduction to jazz music. I was on tour with my jazz album Now, and somebody said that they had this bootleg of me when I was 3 years old. And I said, no, it's not possible. You know, you think I was 3, but I was actually 6. I just thought somebody was going to give me a recording of the album. And then they actually gave me this recording of me singing at age 3, 1970.
Well, let's listen to Bessie Smith, and then we happen to have, courtesy of a friend of mine, a copy of that bootleg. So we're gonna do a little cage match here. Ask our listeners to decide whom they prefer, Bessie Smith or Molly Ringwald, singing A Good Man Is Hard to Find.
My heart is set and I'm all alone. My man treats me mean. I regret the day that I was born and that man I ever seen. My happiness is less today. My heart is broke, that's why I say, not a good man is hard to find. You always get another kind. Yes, when you think that he's your past, you look and find him fooling round some old gal. Then you're right, you are crazy. You wanna see down in his grave. So if your man is nice, take my advice. Hug him in the morning, kiss him at night. Give him plenty of love and treat your good man right. For the good man nowadays sure is hard to find.
Yeah.
Oh my God, what a great voice. She's just amazing. I still feel the same way when I listen to her that I did when I was younger. Just so, she just sounds so strong, and I find myself wanting to yell.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, yeah.
Like a feminist moment.
Yeah.
Do you feel a little like you were emulating Bessie Smith when you sang a Bessie Smith song? Like
totally.
You were trying to cop that attitude?
Oh, yeah. That's totally what I did. She was just like, no bullshit, you know? She was just singing out. And there was just something that I really responded to when I was a kid. I mean, that's the kind of singing that I did. It felt very strong, really direct. And that's really what I was moved by. You know, I didn't feel like a shy little kid. I felt very strong.
Well, I hope what we're going to be able to do is somehow fade elegantly into this other artist who also recorded this song memorably. This is Molly Ringwald at 3 years old. This is freakish to me. This is freakish to me because, I mean, three is really young.
Yeah.
And you really sang this song. It stayed sung.
Yeah.
It goes a little something like this. I like your tempo better.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's my dad. And you can hear him right at the end. He tells me to hold it at the end.
And hold it, you did.
Yeah.
Did you play Annie?
I did not.
Were you in Annie?
I was in Annie. I was in the first West Coast production of Annie at the Schubert Theater and at the Curran Theater
but
in San Francisco.
But you weren't Annie herself.
I was not.
It's too bad because you got lungs.
I know. And I auditioned for the understudy, too, and he didn't give it to me. I was really shy. I was really, really shy.
That's interesting, but not...
I mean, I could have done it. I mean, I've always been really pretty terrible, I think, with auditions. I have a hard time sort of selling myself, but once I'm in,
yeah,
I can do anything. And a lot of people don't really understand that. And yeah, so he didn't give me that part. He didn't give me the understudy part. But it was okay. I mean, I was part of the chorus, and I think it's important to be part of the chorus for a long time and know what that's about.
Bullshit. I want that part.
Of course. Of course you want the part. And I was heartbroken when I didn't get even to be the understudy for Annie. But in retrospect, I think it's really important.
You couldn't have been that shy if you got into the cast. I mean, there's only six girls, right?
I mean, I auditioned. I was a tap dancer also, and I auditioned to play to play Molly because I was really little when I auditioned. And they knew that I was a tap dancer, and they said, okay, can you get your tap shoes? And I lied, and I said that I left them at home because I was too afraid to tap for all these people. Like, if I was on stage, I would have been fine, but being in the room around all these other kids, and it was just so, it was daunting.
You can tap?
Well, I could.
Can you tap now?
I could do the numbers from Annie, but
really,
but, yeah,
you astonish me. That's another thing that I didn't know that you did really well.
You knew that I danced. I mean, I don't consider myself a great dancer at all, but at that time I was dancing all the time. I thought
you're one of those actors who moves well.
I am. That's what I consider myself. I consider myself an actor who can move okay, and I can learn choreography, but it's definitely not my strong suit. I don't lead with it.
You know, cut to what? I don't know, 30-some years later maybe? I can't be sure of the math, but you end up on Broadway mm-hmm. playing Sally Bowles
yeah.
in Cabaret. Did you dance during that?
I did. I did. I danced in that, but that was choreographed for Natasha Richardson, who didn't really sing or dance.
She's even a worse dancer than you.
She just really didn't dance that much. And Sally was not supposed to be a great dancer or singer. She was really... It was really more about the performance, I think.
No question. I mean, Liza yeah. changed it when she did it.
Yeah.
And she considered herself a dancer first of all things.
Yeah. Yeah. She was an amazing dancer.
Crazily.
And I don't know if I would consider her an amazing singer. You might disagree with me.
Ooh, let's have a fight about Liza Minnelli.
I think
this will be the second gayest thing that ever happened on this show.
I think that she is an interesting singer. I don't think that it's about her singing. I think that she had something that was completely different. I mean, I just think it was more about her and about her personality. Like, I don't think that she was the singer that her mother was.
Well, obviously, I mean, okay, that's not fair because, you know, comparing yeah. her to the one other human being on the planet who's the greatest singer of all time is not really fair to her.
Yeah, I know. But I
mean,
do
if she's
think...
better than 99% of the other singers, that makes her a great singer.
Yeah, yeah. Fight with me. No, I just...
You don't listen to Liza Minnelli no. like you listen to Bessie Smith.
No, yeah, or Ella Fitzgerald or any other, you know, singers that I happen to really like. It's just a taste thing. But I do like watching her, and I also think that she was the best Sally Bowles that I've ever seen.
What good is sitting alone in your room? Or come hear the music play. Life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret.
Liza Minnelli. Liza Minnelli, a performer for the ages, if not for Molly Ringwald. In just a moment, the song that brings Molly to tears just talking about it. Okay. It's not the only song that brings her to tears.
So come to the cabaret.
This is the Naked American Songbook. I'm Julian Fleischer. My guest this hour is Molly Ringwald, who has a soft spot for Depression-era tearjerkers. Her next choice was a tune sung by Andy Bay. And while she loves his beautiful performance, it's really all about the song.
I always find Brother Kenny's Paradigm very moving. I find it a very American song, and it's about a time in our history during the Great Depression. I perform this song, and I talk about how one of the reasons why I keep singing songs from the Great American Songbook is I find them incredibly relevant to what's going on today. And I just never get sick of them. This song is one of those songs that, you know, it could have been written yesterday. Just that idea about, like, I was there for you, and I bought it, hook, line, and sinker. And I put my time in, and I fought for this country. I fought for you, and look what I have now. Look what's going on. I know.
I get very emotional.
I get very emotional about it. I think it's a really incredible song. I don't read music, which is just one of the tragedies, the regret. I try not to have a lot of regrets, but one of my big regrets is that I didn't keep playing piano and learning right. music. And
you know that that's okay, though.
I know.
Many of the singers you love the most don't read music.
I know.
And that's why they're good singers.
Well, here's what I don't like about it, though, is I depend on other people's interpretations before I can make my own. And sometimes I'll get somebody else's phrasing or whatever in my head, and I'd like to just have my own or at least start with my own.
Well, forgive me for saying, Andy Bay's interpretation is not evident in yours.
But the one thing that I do is I'd never heard it done fast before.
Right.
Usually, you know, when you hear it, you know, once I built a railroad, made it run. You know, it's like that slow.
You sound good today.
Thank you. But I'd never heard it done like this before, and I just found it very exciting. And I find his voice just incredible. But I'm going to add that I played this for my father. My father and I share a lot. That's sort of our quality time. We listen to music together and sort of break it down and talk about it.
Like what we're doing now?
Like what we're doing now.
Do I remind you of your dad?
No. But one thing about my dad that I think that you share this is, you know, he's very honest. He's very straightforward. And he won't say that he likes something when he doesn't. So when I played this for him, you know, he thought it was interesting. But Andy Bay's voice doesn't move him in the way that it moves me. So I really do think that it's completely subjective.
It's interesting because I agree with your dad. I listened to this when you sent it to me and my feeling was,
Oh,
I don't know if this is for me.
Really?
I mean, he has a beautiful instrument and I'm all for changing up tempos and listening to songs newly and recontextualizing them, what have you, jazzing up pop or popping up jazz.
Yeah.
But this song in particular seems to have a very specific message and to hear it sung that fast makes the lyric go by in a blur and doesn't, I don't think.
But I sing it very fast.
Your lyrics didn't go, I don't think you sing it this fast because I remember when you did it, it made a lot of sense to me. But we can debate it all day long.
Okay, listen to it.
We will ask our listeners to decide which one of us is right as we play Andy Bay's long version.
Oh, come on.
I mean, it's both fast and long.
Once I built a railroad, made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower to the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once in khaki suits, cheap wheat looked swell. We were full of that. Half a million men, I went slogging through hell. I was the kid with the drum. Say, don't you remember? My name is Al. It was Al all the time. Say, don't you remember? I'm your pal, brother. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a railroad, made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower to the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, brother, can you spare a dime?
Andy Bay doing his version of Brother, Can You Spare a Dime?
And now that you've played it for me a second time, I have to say it's growing on me.
Thank you.
And I appreciate the...
I don't know
the
how...
The lesson I learned today.
I don't know how you can listen to that and not love... I mean, I think his voice is...
He has a great voice.
It's amazing. It just has this really beautiful, buttery quality to it. But also I love how loose he is and how improvisational, and he accompanies himself, and I always feel like singers that play piano are really interesting and gives them a kind of freedom with their phrasing. He blows me away.
I totally agree. I mean, his voice is absolutely gorgeous. Mm-hmm. But I think, as we were saying earlier, and I'm really glad we said it because I think it's going to play out in this whole conversation, is like certain people just get moved by certain sounds.
And
I'm one of those people who tends to listen mostly to female singers.
Me too.
With two big exceptions. But his voice reminds me a lot of Joe Williams.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too.
Do you like Joe Williams?
I do.
Because I brought for you a Joe Williams recording that's a lifetime favorite of mine. And I thought this would be sort of a nice compliment to the Andy Bay recording, because I'm sure that Bay must pay, in some part of his psyche, a huge debt of gratitude to Joe Williams.
Probably.
Who I think never really got famous enough. He was always sort of like the Count Basie band with Joe Williams.
You know,
He was sort of below title a little bit too often. Although I saw him once at Carnegie Hall, just headline, and it was unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Williams and Ella Fitzgerald with the Count Basie Orchestra doing Every Day I Have the Blues. And I don't know if you know this recording, but for me it's spine tingling.
Yeah.
He holds the super long note at the end. It's so great.
I want to hear it.
Nobody loves me. Nobody sings. Yeah. Nobody.
Cow.
Isn't that extraordinary?
Yeah.
Count Basie, Joe Williams, Ella Fitzgerald, Every Day I Have the Blues.
That is amazing. I said before that it was just, you know, the lyric, the ability to express emotion, which I still think is the most important thing to me. But there are some times when you listen to something and it's just so exciting mm-hmm. when you listen to this virtuosic quality that Ella Fitzgerald and Joe Williams have, where you just think, how is that possible? How do they do that?
I mean,
you know, they didn't have all of the tools, the pro tools that we have, you know, back then. They just brought it.
I completely agree with you. And like you, I spend a lot of time just sitting, listening and going, how?
Yeah.
You know, like having two experiences at once. One is just like being filled with joy, jumping up and down, swinging back and forth, acting like, you know, a primate.
Yeah.
And the other is going like all head, like, okay, so it's the vibrato, but then he does the thing with the thing.
Yeah.
When did he breathe? You know, like trying always to understand this thing that cannot be understood.
I feel like they just opened their mouth and sang. They didn't spend a lot of time breaking things down like we
do. I think that's true for her.
Who, for Ella?
Especially,
yeah. Although I have heard that Ella, more than somebody like Sarah Vaughan or Anita O'Day or Betty Carter, used to practice all of her scat singing, all of her improv.
Where'd you hear that?
I've heard it a lot.
Cite your sources. I want footnotes.
She makes me think like the Fred Astaire of singing. You look at what he does, and it's the same as Ella Fitzgerald, where it seems so effortless. And I think that there was a lot of work that went into that.
Yes, you are definitely right about that. But her ability to routine the work and then go from there mm-hmm. into uncharted territory every time was what made it special.
Yeah, I don't think it is any less phenomenal at all. I just think she got to where she was through a different avenue than other singers. Sarah Vaughan and Anita O'Day are extraordinary, and they have something that I could never do. I didn't have that ability to improvise or scat sing like they do. But, you know, sometimes they hit some clunkers. Like they don't get it right every single time.
Well, Ella did, but go on. You're wrong about that.
Well, I'm not talking about Ella. I'm talking about Sarah and Anita.
Well, I don't want to talk about it if you're not talking about Ella. No, I do want to talk about it. If Molly Ringwald wants to talk about it, I want to talk about it. But right after this brief intermission. Coming up, we'll hear about Molly's Dixieland band leading father. I'm Julian Fleischer. This is the Naked American Songbook. And right now, I'd like to bring out a little segment we like to call This is all about a performance that really just, I don't know.
Totally
nailed it.
Stuck the landing.
Late in my conversation with Molly Ringwald, she hipped me to a singer I'd never even heard of, and that doesn't happen frequently here. Nellie Lutcher, Lutcher, is the name of this singer. She was born in 1912. She had a hit with Nat King Cole. And in 1947, she put out a record of a song she wrote herself. And I've heard a few versions of it since Molly first played this one. But I gotta say, Nellie Lutcher's really...
Nailed it!
Let's listen.
Hurry on down to my house, baby. Anybody home but me? Hurry on down to my house, baby. I'm blue as I can be. I love you and you love me. Hurry through the alley so the neighbors won't see you. Hurry on down to my house, baby. Anybody home but me? Hurry on down to my house, baby. Ain't nobody home but me. Hurry on down, baby. I'm blue as I can be. Mama's gone for the whole long day. Just think of it, honey. We'll have a long time to play. If you hurry on down, anybody home but me? Hurry. Anybody home but me? Hey. Oh, down. I'm blue as I can be. The cuckoo in the clock is going tick tock tick. Oh, come on, honey. Quick. Hurry on down, baby. Anybody home but me? Back
down, baby. I'm blue as I can be. Please come down just as soon as you can. If you can't, I'll have to call Sam. He'll hurry on down, anybody home but me.
Hurry on down. Sung by the writer herself, Nellie Lutcher, L-U-T-C-H-E-R. Go check her out, as I did after Molly played that song for me after our conversation when the mics were off. Thanks a lot, Molly.
Nailed it!
Now, back to our conversation. Molly shared with me the standard I'll Be Seeing You, performed live by Sarah Vaughan. Now, you may recall earlier in the show, we discussed how Molly's first time on stage at age 3 was to sing with her father, pianist Bob Ringwald, and his Fulton Street Jazz Band. One other detail I gingerly referenced, Molly's father, Bob Ringwald, is also blind.
Well, I recorded this song for my father's album, and whenever I perform and my dad is there, I always invite him on stage. And this is the song that we do together. It's so moving. It's hard, actually, to get through it. It's hard for me to look at him when he plays.
Cathedral bells were tolling, and our hearts sang on. Was it the spell of Paris or the April dawn?
I don't know if you have this experience when you're on stage with your father.
I've been on the stage with my father exactly once, and it happened a month ago.
And was it hard? Was it hard? I mean, did you feel like you were overcome by emotion, or were you just nervous, or what?
It was one of the most moving experiences of my life because he was playing a song I wrote, arranged for the left hand alone.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a song of goodbye.
Oh.
And
I would have liked to have seen that.
And because he hadn't had a chance to really rehearse it that much, he was struggling.
Oh.
And, he's a titan. And so it's funny to see someone who you've only seen blow people's minds, literally staring desperately at the music, trying to make it happen.
Yeah.
He played beautifully. It was astonishing, but yes.
So you know what that feels like.
Yes.
And
your dad, if I may let our audience know, because I think it's relevant, is not a seeing person. He's blind.
That's right.
That's the term people use.
He's
blind. Now, he's always been blind?
He's always been blind.
It's astonishing that anybody can play the piano at all, but to do so as a blind person, at the risk of putting too fine a point on it, I'll Be Seeing You is an interesting song to share with your dad when he's, at least visually blind.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many elements. I mean, it's a beautiful song. It was a song that was sung very often for the soldiers during World War II. Even thinking about singing this with my dad makes me cry. So you can imagine how hard it is. I've never been one of those people, unlike Anne Hathaway, it seems, who's the only person I know who can sing on pitch and cry at the same time. So hats off to her. She totally deserved the Academy Award for that. I'm not one of those people. When I cry, I go completely off pitch. So I really try not to, which means that I can barely look at him. I mean, we've done it enough now where I can sort of look at him while he's doing his solo and I get through it. So I find it a really moving song. I'd actually really love to record it again. So anyway, how I learned this song was listening to Sarah Vaughan's recording, which I also find moving.
Anything about it in particular we should be paying attention to?
I think her voice is just beautiful. She has this incredible operatic range. I love the tempo. She does it really slowly. I love the song, but I love the way that she does it. I find it beautiful, and also it makes the hair stand up on my arms.
In every lovely summer's day, everything that
beginning, the moon, and all I'll see is you.
About that.
Yeah. It's sometimes you listen to something like that and you just think, okay, what's the point? Why? Why do I bother? Why do I bother? I mean, she's just...
I think that is a good point. It's, yeah. It's a question I ask myself all the time. As yeah. someone like you who sings this repertoire, like, it's clearly been sung pretty well.
Yeah.
Am I
yeah.
going to do anything that...
I do.
Obviously, we'll never sing like that.
Yeah. I tried on my album to pick songs that weren't sung ad nauseum, you know, that were a little bit more obscure. And I also do feel like I bring something different to,
of course.
You know, yeah, I will never sing like that, but I don't know if that's really the point.
You're going to communicate something human,
mm-hmm.
obviously,
yeah.
if you're in it and you're meaning it and you're singing it well, it's going to resonate with your audience. It's a great song, and that's the whole point. But there is always this weird seesaw in your
yeah.
spirit about, like, I want to sing this song. Oh, my God. It's, you know, it's already been perfected.
Yeah.
And that performance, I've never heard it, actually. I'm glad you brought it. It's hair-raising.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I talk a lot about her vocals on this show because they're just so astonishing. It's like something from outer space.
I know. And when I listen to it, it really makes me think about if she was born today, if she would have sung jazz or if she would have sung opera.
I don't know, but I think she has probably the greatest sort of raw instrument that it ever was.
Yeah.
And because she uses operatic sounds, but always in the hippest way.
Yeah. And apparently she, when she scat sang, like, she did not rehearse it. It was always just completely.
But she was also a jazz pianist. So she
knew, helps. Yeah.
I'm sure that's a different sort of thing. But I'm not going to have you taking backhanded swipes at Ella.
I love Ella. After Bessie Smith, it was all Ella all the time.
I heard the implication, Molly. One of the things about that songbook I think that's most sort of challenging is that it seems to have a beginning and an end.
Yes.
A lot of people believe it stopped at a certain point when these writers sort of stop writing.
I know, and I don't agree with that. I feel like, I mean, most of the songs that I do are from what is known as the Great American Songbook, but I'm really trying to put songs that I believe should be a part of the Great American Songbook written by composers that I feel like we if we're going to keep this thing going,
right.
If we're still going to have an American songbook that's great, we need to have new inductees.
Well, certainly if there's any recent inductee into the Great American Songbook, it's Sondheim. And he's not even that recent, frankly. I mean, he's been writing great songs for decades and decades. But unlike Gershwin and Porter and Kern and Ellington and all the legends, you know, Sondheim is still alive and he's still writing great songs. But even so, he's sort of a quote-unquote new inductee into the, you know, the Hall of Fame when
okay.
it comes to the Great American Songbook. And you, I know, just recorded a song of his that sounds for all the world like an old standard.
Yeah.
He wrote it for Madonna for the movie Dick Tracy. In the movie, she sings this to Warren Beatty, whom I know, by the way, is a friend of yours, but I'm not saying you're singing this to him. Anyway, this is you, Molly, singing Sooner or Later.
Sooner or later, you're gonna be mine. Sooner or later, you're gonna be fine. Baby, it's time that you face it at all. Always get my man. Sooner or later you're gonna decide. Sooner or later there's nowhere to hide. Baby, it's time, so I waste it and chatter. Let's settle the matter. Baby, you're mine on a platter. I always get my man. But if you insist, babe, the challenge delights me. The more you resist, babe, the more it excites me. No. babe ever fights me again. If you're on my list, it's just a question of when. When I get a yen, then baby, amen. I'm counting to 10.
Molly Ringwald, I love that version of that song.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being my guest on season 2 of the Naked American Songbook with Julian Pleasure. I'm your host, Julian Pleasure.
And you haven't mentioned that I am naked while we're doing
that. Oh, it's understood at this point. It's understood. She's actually right. I should be saying that the reason we call it the Naked American Songbook, among other things, is that we just get to sit here.
Be naked.
Buck naked. You can finally see what you've wanted to see all these years. Oh, no, you saw it once.
It's true, I did.
Right.
It was impressive.
It's everything you've heard about.
Yeah, everything.
Molly, thank you so much for being on the Naked American Songbook. Let's go have lunch.
All right.
And that is, as they say, a wrap for me and Molly Ringwald. Thank you for listening. Be sure to get in on the conversation by chatting us up on all the various social media, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, on our show page, nakedamericansongbook.org. If you subscribe to the podcast version, you'll get all sorts of bonus features, previews, bloopers, and other extras. And you can always request a song on the Naked American Listener line at 347-229-1343. Whatever you do, be in touch and be naked when you do it. The Naked American Songbook is a production of WNYC, WQXR, and the Jonathan Channel in New York City. Members of our Naked Little Breakfast Club include executive producer Michael Shoeb as The Jock, producer Aaron Dalton as The Nerd, assistant producer Ellie Smerling is our Freak, our intern Hilary Bonhomme is the Popular Girl, and I'm Julian Fleischer, your resident bad boy. Thanks for listening. Keep it naked. I'm done. I don't want to be the popular girl. I wouldn't mind being the freak. What?
We got to talk about that off air.
I don't think they're rolling. They're the worst.